assassinated, and the question really was the role of the CIA in that assassination, I believe, was much stronger than what the CIA has said over the decades. There's clearly the CIA helped track Lumumba as he tried to escape, and also had sent hitmen to Congo to try to kill him. So it was very clear that the CIA played a pivotal role in all that.
James Risen, we're going to do part two of this discussion, and we're going to talk more about what ultimately the Church Committee was able to publicly expose with these assassinations. James Risen, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter at The Intercept, his new book is called The Last Honest Man, The CIA, The FBI, The Mafia, and The Kennedys, and When Senators Fight to Save Democracy. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO, Portland Community Radio. Yeah!
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a new report from the U.S. Senate shows the FBI and Homeland Security failed to act on intel to prevent the Capitol insurrection. Oregon passes a first-in-the-nation restriction on nurse-to-patient ratios in hospitals. And in international news, the White House rolls out the red carpet for the Prime Minister of India. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 27th, 2023. I'm Eric Leuschner. A Senate panel report says the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security downplayed or ignored a huge amount of intelligence information ahead of the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol. The report details how the agencies failed to recognize and warn of the potential for violence, as some of then-President Donald Trump's supporters openly planned the attack, repeatedly talking about it in messages and online forums. The agencies were said to be aware of many social media posts that foreshadowed violence, some calling on Trump's supporters to come armed to storm the Capitol and to burn down the building. For example, a December 2020 FBI tip stated members of the far-right extremist group Proud Boys planned to be in Washington, D.C. for the certification of Joe Biden's victory. Allegedly, their plan literally included killing people. The Senate committee collected dozens of emails as well as material from interviews. This is the first congressional report to focus solely on the actions of the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security's Office of Intelligence and Analysis. Michigan Senator Gary Peters, Democrat and panel chair, said the breakdown was, quote, largely a failure of imagination to see threats that the Capitol could be breached as credible, end quote. The report said the intelligence community has not entirely focused on the threats of domestic rather than international terrorism, and that government intelligence leaders failed to sound the alarm. But the panel said the reasons for dismissing what was called a massive amount of intelligence were not easily explained. It added there was not a failure to obtain evidence, but rather a failure to fully and accurately assess how severe the threat from that intelligence was and to formally give guidance to law enforcement. On January 6th, thousands of Trump supporters marched to the Capitol, overran law enforcement, assaulted police officers, and caused more than $2.7 billion in damage to the building. Rioters temporarily interrupted the certification of the election victory by Joe Biden. Even as the attack was happening, the FBI and Homeland Security downplayed the threat. At a 10 a.m. briefing, as protesters near the Capitol were wearing ballistic helmets and body armor and were carrying radio equipment and military-grade backpacks, the FBI briefed that there were, quote, no credible threats at this time, end quote. The lack of sufficient warnings meant that law enforcement was not adequately prepared and could not establish a harder perimeter around the Capitol. That typically happens during events like the annual State of the Union address. The social media company Parler, a favorite platform for the Trump supporters, directly sent the FBI several posts it found alarming. One post said, quote, this is not a rally and it's no longer a protest. This is a final stand where we are drawing a red line at the Capitol Hill. Don't be surprised if we take the building, end quote. The panel report calls for a reevaluation of the federal government's domestic intelligence collection, analysis, and dissemination process. Homeland Security said that the department has already made many changes 2.5 years after the attack on the Capitol. It claims it has strengthened intelligence analysis and operational preparedness to help prevent acts of violence. The FBI director, Christopher Wray, defended the FBI's handling of the intelligence in the run-up to the January 6th assault on the Capitol. The FBI said that since the attack, they have focused on quick information sharing and centralizing the flow of information to make sure other entities are notified in a timely way. Previous investigation panels focused mostly on Trump's actions, with a House panel concluding the former president criminally engaged in a multi-part conspiracy to overturn the lawful results from the 2020 presidential election, and that he failed to stop his supporters from attacking the Capitol. Oregon lawmakers have passed a tax credit that will help low-income families. The policy is modeled after the expanded federal child tax credit from 2021. Eric Tegedoff spoke with Tyler Mack Innes from the Oregon Center for Public Policy to learn more.
Low-income families in Oregon will receive a boost from tax credit legislation passed in Salem. Lawmakers have approved House Bill 3235, which creates a $1,000 credit for every child from birth to age 5 in households where earnings are $25,000 a year. The credit phases out above that to incomes of $30,000. Tyler McInnes with the Oregon Center for Public Policy says his organization found nearly 55,000 children across all 36 counties will be eligible for the credit.
This policy, the Oregon Kids Credit, is really about targeting our resources at the state level to help the families in greatest need and ensure that we have a more economically just state.
The legislation passed with near unanimous support in both the House and Senate, with only one lawmaker objecting in each chamber. It now heads to Governor Tina Kotek's desk. The so-called Oregon Kids Credit is set to go into place in 2024. McInnes says the credit was modeled after the federal child tax credit, which Congress temporarily expanded during the pandemic in 2021.
We saw child poverty nationwide cut almost in half. We saw racial disparities experienced by children reduced significantly. And so we saw the impacts of families who are struggling with the rising costs of raising kids, what it could mean to just give them some added cash.
McInnes says the legislation also includes a mechanism for distributing the child tax credit in advanced quarterly payments. Before that goes into place, the state will have to find out if the payments would be considered income when determining eligibility for federal aid programs like food assistance. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A community meeting ended prematurely as residents clashed with county representatives over a proposed houselessness solution. Washington County had revealed plans to create temporary housing in the form of a Safe Rest Village site at the Aloha United Methodist Church parking lot. It would have about 40 pods and was expected to open to unhoused people in late summer. The plan was to keep it open for 2 years. The meeting did not go as planned. Fewer than 10 minutes into the meeting, stakeholders began shouting out questions. They apparently felt left out of the decision-making process. Locals claimed the county had already bought all the supplies for the site and that the location was not discussed with them. County representatives acknowledged that they had not discussed the location with the community. The county now says it is taking the community's concerns into consideration. It also plans to have a code of conduct for residents. Alcohol, drugs, weapons, and open flames will be prohibited. Case management conferences will take place twice weekly, and residents must accept housing opportunities offered. They also have to accept unit inspections. Jess Larson, assistant director of the Washington County Department of Housing Services, said, quote, "Every time we go about creating a new shelter program, it's hard for the local community. It's change, it's uncertainty, and it's something new that feels a little scary. It's important that we have these community conversations so we can address those questions and hopefully build a strong neighborhood plan and ensure safety for everyone involved," end quote. CNN has obtained an audio recording in which former President Donald Trump discusses holding onto highly confidential documents. It appears to undermine his claims that he didn't possess such records. The recording was made at a July 2021 interview Trump gave at his Bedminster, New Jersey resort for people working on the memoir of Mark Meadows, Trump's former chief of staff. It first aired on CNN's Anderson Cooper 360. The recording is a critical piece of evidence in Special Counsel Jack Smith's indictment of Trump over the mishandling of classified information. Specifically, Trump seems to indicate he was holding onto a secret Pentagon document with plans to attack Iran. Trump said, quote, "These are the papers," end quote, while he's discussing those plans. That quote was not included in the indictment. In the two-minute audio recording, Trump and his aides also joke about Hillary Clinton's emails after the former president says that the document was secret information. Trump's statement on the audio recording include a reference to something he calls highly confidential. He seems to be showing it to others in the room, which could undercut the former president's claims that he did not possess any such documents. Trump told Fox, quote, "There was no document. I didn't have a document, per se. There was nothing to declassify. These were newspaper stories, magazine stories, and articles," end quote. Trump pleaded not guilty earlier this month to 37 counts related to the alleged mishandling of classified documents kept at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Palm Beach, Florida. A CNN legal analyst calls this recording the single most important piece of evidence in the Trump indictment. Trump also offered a new reason for not giving the classified material to investigators. He said in the recording, quote, "This was done by the military and given to me. See, as president, I could have declassified it. Now I can't, you know, but this is still a secret," end quote. A staffer responds, quote, "Now we have a problem." A Trump campaign spokesman said the audio recording provides context proving President Trump did nothing wrong. Trump himself claimed yesterday the recording is actually an exoneration. Legislation passed in Salem creates staffing ratios for nurses and patients in hospitals. Oregon now becomes the first state in the country to pass staffing standards of this kind. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Oregon lawmakers have passed a first-of-its-kind bill creating minimum nurse-to-patient ratios in hospitals. House Bill 2697 creates minimum standards for the number of nurses on staff across hospitals, from emergency departments to labor and delivery units. Matt Swanson with the SEIU Oregon State Council says the legislation is a win for patients.
This law, when implemented, is going to mean that you will have somebody at your bedside that is well able to meet your needs, rested, and has working conditions that really allow them to focus on the needs of the patient.
The Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems initially opposed the bill, but moved to support it after flexibilities were included, such as for rural hospitals. The bill now heads to Governor Tina Kotek's desk. Implementation will start on September 1st. Swanson says burnout among nurses accelerated during the pandemic, which is one reason why workers from across the state came forward to push for this legislation in Salem.
These are folks who care a lot about the communities they serve, and their voices were so important to developing a good law, giving the legislature the courage to take a bold stand on safe staffing in our hospitals.
The legislation also sets up staffing committees for other employees in hospitals, including pharmacists and environmental services workers. Swanson says there are enforcement mechanisms for the staffing standards in the bill as well. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Clark County Larch Corrections Center will close this fall because the prison population has declined significantly. It's located in Yakult, Washington, and it's a minimum security prison that can house 240 people. Washington's prison population has been declining in recent years, and it's expected to continue. Only 70% of prison beds are occupied statewide. The facility will be so-called warm closed, which means it could reopen in the future if necessary. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. At 6 o'clock, it's This Way Out. Then at 7, For the Wild. Tonight's weather, we'll see a few clouds in the evening, but mostly clear with an overnight low of 54 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be warm and sunny with a high of 83 degrees. Today in history, in 1915, American author and activist Grace Lee Boggs was born. She started her activism as a member of the Left Workers' Party. She is regarded as a key figure in the Asian American, Black Power, and civil rights movements. The quote of the day is from Boggs, who said, quote, "You begin with a protest, but you have to move on from there. Just being angry, just being resentful, just being outraged does not constitute revolution." New York passes numerous laws to protect the LGBTQ plus community. Iowa's Supreme Court blocks another 6-week abortion ban. And Washington's Supreme Court upholds the state's Voting Rights Act. With more on the story, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Throughout the past, we've had to march together. We've had to challenge the status quo. We've had to stand up against injustices of every form, and we've won those battles.
Prior to New York City's Pride March, Governor Kathy Hochul signed legislation to protect the rights of the LGBTQ community, including bills establishing New York State as a safe haven for transgender youth, protecting private health information, and prohibiting law enforcement from targeting transgender youth. 20 GOP-led states have passed or are considering laws banning gender care for children and some adults. Currently, 17 states have total or partial bans on this kind of care for children or minors, with at least 3 states' bans being blocked. In a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing recently, ranking Republican Lindsey Graham said he was unconvinced a transgender female athlete competing on a cisgender women's team was fair. Endocrinologist Dr. Ximena Lopez testified before the committee about the medical aspects of gender-affirming care, noting it can be life-saving.
This care is based on a careful, individualized assessment of adolescents with significant and persistent gender dysphoria, which, when left untreated, predictably can cause serious harms, including anxiety, depression, suicidality, and other negative physical and mental health impacts.
Iowa civil rights advocates are adamant about fighting off abortion bans. Recently, the state Supreme Court blocked a 6-week abortion ban. For now, a 20-week ban remains in effect. A similar law proposing a 6-week abortion ban was passed by the legislature in 2018, though the state Supreme Court overturned it. But given the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade about a year ago, laws like this are more common. ACLU of Iowa legal director Rita Betts Austin was against this ban and the one in 2018. Despite the ban having support from Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds, Betts Austin plans to keep fighting future measures like these.
This abortion ban was dangerous, cruel, and unconstitutional when it was blocked 4 years ago. It remains dangerous, cruel, and unconstitutional.
Justices in Washington State Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the state's Voting Rights Act. The case is aimed at helping Latino residents gain representation in local politics, given they make up a majority of the population. States like New York and Connecticut passed their own voting rights laws, and experts say this ruling could resonate across the U.S. Yuri Rudensky with the Brennan Center for Justice is encouraged by the court's decision.
States have an important role to play in ensuring that all voters are treated fairly, that the rules that apply to elections, to representation, don't deny people opportunities based on race.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
New research from Adobe Foundation and the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, shows the powerful benefits of creative activities on mental health. Those are especially prominent for young people experiencing loneliness, anxiety, or depression, as well as for the LGBTQ plus community and other marginalized groups. Catherine Carley has more.
Young people who engage in creative activities report a reduction in feelings of stress or anxiety, according to a new study. The Adobe Foundation and National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI, found more than 60% of young people surveyed reported an improved sense of confidence through painting, writing, or any form of creative expression. NAMI's Frederick Miggins says improving access to creative activities could help turn the tide on a youth mental health crisis.
Creative expression is something that just about anyone can engage in person or online. This makes it one of the most accessible ways for people to invest in supporting their own mental well-being.
Megan says creative expression is not a substitute for professional mental health treatment, but rather an important tool in managing one's overall well-being and sense of purpose. The survey found younger people were more likely than the general population to say creative expression strengthened their sense of identity or belonging in a community. LGBTQ plus respondents were more likely than heterosexual respondents to say that creative activities improved their mental health and boosted their sense of community. Megan says at a time when so many LGBTQ plus youth feel targeted, online influencers are helping inspire young people to get creative themselves.
You know, at a time where a lot of the social media landscape can feel unwelcoming or antagonistic to people with queer identities, it's a great reminder that there's beauty and support out there.
Megan says trans kids in particular revealed even greater mental health benefits from creative expression. He says it's important for people struggling with mental illness to realize they're not alone and that creative activities can also be done with a family member or friend. For Maine News Service, I'm Catherine Carley. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
National parks are likely to see record attendance this summer, but some options could help people beat the crowds. Eric Tegedoff spoke with a public lands professor at Boise State University to learn more.
America's national parks are bracing for another record year of attendance, but overcrowding in the parks could take away some of their magic. National parks saw more than 300 million visitors in 2022. However, Professor Emily Wakefield at Boise State University says parks are seeing funding decreasing year after year.
How to use the funds that do exist to address the backlog of maintenance that hasn't been kept up, but also to plan for new technologies. So things like electric bikes or recreational motorhomes that are now twice the size of regular homes.
Wakefield says this also challenges gateway communities that surround parks, some of which became popular so-called Zoom towns during the pandemic as people moved to places where they could be near outdoor recreation while working remotely. Wakefield says one option to help with overcrowding is to stagger attendance at popular sites. Bogus Basin Mountain Recreation Area outside of Boise has done this successfully. Wakefield says the area uses pricing structures to spread crowds out, and as a result, the parking lot only filled up once last ski season.
They were able to pull people up to the mountain at different times and really kind of maximize the user experience, and that was a creative strategy for mitigating some of the crowding and some of the conflict that might come with it.
Wakefield says people also should consider public places besides the well-known national parks.
There's so much more that public lands have to offer, and those opportunities will often provide people with a more satisfying experience, even if it doesn't have the brand name.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Corn-based ethanol is not as good for the climate as once thought. The environmental repercussions of plowing grasslands and using fertilizer can outweigh the benefits to the climate. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For decades, the amount of cropland in the U.S. was shrinking as farmers converted more land into pastures, grasslands, or other natural areas. As their practices became more efficient, farmers needed less space, so they could set aside some land to benefit the environment. But in the mid-2000s, that trend reversed, and cropland began expanding.
Things like pasture land or conservation grasslands being plowed up and going back into production really made us look closer at this and ask what's driving these changes.
That's Tyler Lark of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He says this reversal was driven in part by the Renewable Fuel Standard, a federal program that requires biofuels to be blended into fuel. That mandate prompted farmers to grow more corn for corn-based ethanol. So many farmers plowed up grasslands, releasing carbon from the soil. And they applied fertilizer, which also emits global warming pollution.
We saw that the overall emissions associated with those land use changes were quite sizable, and in many cases overshadowed some of the potential savings that corn ethanol offered relative to gasoline.
So he says the research underscores the need to scale up other, less carbon-intensive sources of biofuels. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
India's President Narendra Modi got the red carpet treatment in a recent visit to the White House. But what does this strategic partnership mean for the future? Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. President Biden welcomed India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi with much pomp and ceremony. One senior U.S. official said, quote, "There is no partner more consequential now and into the future than India." Quite a statement that Japan, South Korea, and Australia might quarrel with. The president and other officials were effusive in praising India. Two democracies with shared value systems, said Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor. But beneath the surface of this high-profile engagement is one fact. The purpose of the visit was to cement India's strategic partnership with the U.S., thereby accomplishing an overriding objective for each side: for India to gain access to U.S. military technology, and for the U.S. to extend containment of China in Asia. Democracy has nothing to do with the two countries' increasing closeness. From the strategic standpoint, we would have to judge Modi's visit a success. A parade of senior U.S. officials has been visiting India recently to help India upgrade its military-industrial complex and strengthen ties in the Quad security dialogue that also includes India, Japan, Australia, and the U.S. The U.S. and India together monitor Chinese economic and military activity in the Indian Ocean. They've established a joint forum on defense technology integration called INDUS-X. Modi's visit ensures that India will become a prime market for U.S. military exports. One deal he and Biden concluded is for General Electric to build military jet engines in India in partnership with a state-owned Indian aeronautical company. The deal meets a major Indian defense concern, modernizing its jet fighters. For GE and other U.S. military industries, the deal also promises long-term Indian dependence on U.S. jet engine technology and other equipment. That dependence will mean less Indian reliance on Russian weapons, an aim vocalized by a senior U.S. official who said, quote, "You'll see major cancellations of defense system purchases from Russia, in part because we know Russia can't actually provide it, that Russia is consuming its own defense production very quickly in this terrible war in Ukraine." As for shared values, Biden surely is aware that India is another of those illiberal democracies. The press and courts are under pressure from Modi, and violence against Muslims is commonplace. In one international ranking of democracies, India is considered an electoral autocracy. The main leader of the political opposition, Rahul Gandhi, has been jailed and deprived of his seat in parliament. This week, more than 70 Democratic lawmakers urged President Biden in a letter to press upholding democratic values and human rights with the Indian Prime Minister, citing, quote, "troubling signs in India toward the shrinking of political space, the rise of religious intolerance, the targeting of civil society organizations and journalists, and growing restrictions on press freedoms and internet access." But Modi is immensely popular, cultivating his image as the indefatigable Hindu leader by dominating the news in India, using FDR-style monthly radio chats, and seeming to be concerned about people's day-to-day problems. His game is to preserve the figment of democracy at home while exploiting big powers abroad. In fact, the visit to the U.S. is bound to embolden him to aggrandize power even more, knowing how much the U.S. needs him. It's an old phenomenon in international politics in which the lesser power has leverage over its major power partner. We've been down this road before. The U.S. overlooks repressive partners when strategic interests are considered overriding. Saudi Arabia is the latest example. But the tactic rarely works, as the Saudis are now demonstrating. Defections to the highest bidder are the norm. China, in that case, as Beijing offered billions of dollars in investments to the Saudis, more oil purchases, and help in reducing tensions with Iran. For all his smiles as the Americans embrace him, Prime Minister Modi is still buying up Russian oil and refusing to condemn Russia's attack on Ukraine. There is no assurance that India will stand with the U.S. in the event of a confrontation with China. Money and arms are the ties that bind, whereas shared values and strategic unity are often fleeting. As Ashley Tillis writes in the latest Foreign Affairs, quote, "As the Biden administration proceeds to expand its investment in India, it should base its policies on a realistic assessment of Indian strategy and not on any delusions of New Delhi becoming a comrade in arms during some future crisis with Beijing." I'm Mel Gertoff for the Global Citizen. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 27th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Mel Gertov, Sam Bowman, and Jasmine Moneymaker. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Edwin J. Vieira, Catherine Carley, Suzanne Potter, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Now stay tuned for Totality of Circumstances.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News, this is Totality of Circumstances, a monthly segment that's focused on police oversight of all kinds in Portland. My name is Sam, and my co-host Jasmine also contributed to this show, but is out of town at the moment. For the last many months, Jasmine and I have been mostly focusing on the ongoing work of the Portland Police Accountability Commission, which you will also hear referred to in this show as the PAC or the PAC. The Police Accountability Commission is